Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
Okay, are you in, Jackie? How's it going? Hannah, right?
Yeah.
Okay, see ya.
I'll be right there.
How's it going?
Good. How are you?
I was freaking out because I couldn't get in at first. And I was like, oh man, they told me 50 minutes, but you know, technology. So.
One second.
Oh man, this is a weird time because the sun is so bright at this time. I get washed out. This is the hour I don't like to teach. It's rough. Hi, Jackie.
Hey, glad you're all here. We were getting a little worried.
Yeah, that's what I was telling her. I was like, freak out. Gosh, this is horrible. No.
Where is the mechanism to save the chat as a panelist?
Automatically saved.
I'm sorry?
Recording. The chat's going to automatically save once the recording finishes. So I'll be able to send you it.
Awesome. Thank you.
And it looks like we have 11 people joined already.
Do we know how many we are expecting?
I do not have that number.
Keith.
Yeah.
In case your loaner goes out, I would suggest you take the Zoom link and send it to yourself on your phone so you can join on your phone if necessary.
So, well, actually I have Gmail on my phone so I could just get it here. I'll open up the email and have it ready.
I had the wrong link. Let me just send this to myself again.
Can't tell you the number of times I've searched for Wiley5 in Gmail last week.
Hi, can you hear me?
Hey, Michelle.
Hello.
You can disregard my text now that you're here.
Good first session. That was good.
Yeah, there are people have so many questions. They're still going, but they're gonna cut them off. And we just put a link in the chat to the agenda in case people were confused at all for where to go for the next sessions. Jackie, could you do me a favor and pronounce your last name for me?
Sure, it's Maraska.
Okay, I thought
Chicago accent, Maraska.
And Keith, it's Nab for you, right?
That's it.
Okay, just wanted to make sure I said it correctly.
Hey Jackie, do you know the date? Let me just to make sure of that email with the link. Oh, November 17th.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, I was just going to tell them I'm just doing damage control in case I get kicked out.
Okay. And then, of course, weirdly, I just got a message that said my internet is unstable. So in case that happens, just let me know and I'll turn off my camera. Maybe. And there's no one else home. So, I mean, it's not, no one's sucking up bandwidth here.
Okay. And our participants have started to join. So we'll give them another couple minutes here and then we'll get started.
Awesome. Any questions for us or are we all set?
Robert Capetta says hi.
Oh. Hey, are you going to tell me someone's going to give me a cue of when to share my screen so I know when to put the PowerPoint up there, or do you want me to do that? Or someone's going to tell
me? If you want to put it up right now, that's fine. Unless you want your faces on for when we, you know, say
hello. I don't mind. Let's just make sure it looks good.
Yep. Sure.
Because then that way I don't have to do that.
Yeah. Get it ready. But you know what? Just having our faces first is an idea. What do you think? Instead of putting up the title, I can go either way.
Hold on. Cause I can't even see an option to share it. Just a sec.
Yeah. Get that fixed first.
Okay, I found it. How's that looking?
Awesome.
Good.
Or if you just want to start with the title slide, that's cool too.
Yeah, I'm just going to start with that. because that way I don't have to hit any more buttons.
And I'm going, oh, shoot. 1 second. Before you start, I got to fix something.
Hey, everyone. We'll go ahead and get started in just a minute here.
Whew, toilet fixed. It was running. Like, I have to sides and my hands are clean. We're good.
All right. Well, my phone tells me that it is 12:01, so I think we'll go ahead and get started. So welcome to all of our attendees, just to make sure that you're in the place that you wanted to be. This is the Culturally Responsive Teaching in Collegiate Mathematics session. Our speakers are Keith Nabb and Jackie Maraska. So Keith teaches mathematics courses at Piedmont Virginia Community College. He earned his PhD from the Department of Math and Science Education at the Illinois Institute of Technology in Chicago. And his interests include student questioning, active learning, and teacher knowledge. Jackie is a STEM instructional coach in a K-8 school district north of Chicago. She provides instructional support, curriculum implementation, and professional development to teachers. She earned her degree in curriculum leadership with a cognitive mathematics from Northern Illinois University, and her research focuses on teachers' mathematical knowledge. For the session today, if you have questions for the speakers, feel free to go ahead and put those in the Q&A. You can use the chat to chat with one another or with me as the panelist. The chat actually might be set up right now to only go to the panelists, but if you have a chat for the group, I will see if I can change that enablement. But with that, I think we are ready to go ahead and get started. So Jackie and Keith, take it away.
All right. Hi, how's everyone doing? I'm Keith Nabb. And as you heard, I teach at Piedmont Virginia Community College. And this is Culturally Responsive Teaching in Collegiate Mathematics. I'm going to let Jackie say hi.
Hi there, everyone. Jackie Maraska. I am a coach at Skokie, Illinois, which is just north of Chicago. So if you wouldn't mind in the chat, go ahead and put your where you teach, including the city and state, would be great so we can get to know each other.
All right, so you want me to advance, Jackie?
Yes, please.
All right, perfect. Okay, take it away.
Thank you. So here's a favorite problem that we've been both using for years in our math content and our math methods courses in higher ed. The problem states, in a particular condominium community, 2/3 of all the men are married to 3/5 of all the women. What fraction of the entire community are married? So we're interested, whether or not you've seen this problem before or not, in what you think about the problem. So what we'd like you to do in the chat box, but don't press enter yet. We would like you to answer the following question. If you are the student, what is your reaction to the problem? But again, I want you to think a moment. I'm going to give a couple minutes of a minute of think time. And on the count of three, I'll ask you to all put your answer to your reaction to the problem in the chat. Please be sure, like Michelle said, to click it to all panelists and attendees, not just panelists, before you press enter. So please put your first reaction to this problem and press enter. 1, 2, 3, enter. And then you can scroll up and take a look at what other people said as well.
And so I don't know, Jackie, do you want to share a couple that you're seeing or?
Yep. So Keith and I are just kind of scrolled just like you are. And I thought the first one was very interesting. What's a condo? Heteronormative. This isn't possible. Confusion. Keith, do you see some things that your students usually see? I see, fractions in all caps.
Yes, fractions is pretty common. I like the, I just see the out of date, right? So these are foreshadowing exactly how my students actually thought about this problem.
And of course you read the description, so you might know, you know, what direction we might be going to this. My head hurts, which I was even quicker. But what we see here, I think you'd agree as you scroll through, is that we see some math reactions, but there are a lot of non-math reactions to this problem. So given that.
Yes, so I can talk a little bit here.
Yeah.
We should also mention that I had a lot of problem like letting this problem go, because if you think about the math in this problem, this is really a pretty difficult mathematics problem dealing with fractions. My audience were math for elementary school teachers. So there was a lot of anxiety about fractions overall. But even in the world of like regular problems that deal with fractions, this problem, there's nothing regular about it. It's a very difficult problem. Okay. So I'm going to share with you here, and this is going to mirror a little bit of what we saw in the chat. So these are some of the questions, right, that students ask me, and we saw some of this in the chat as well, right? Are only men and women married? Hey, no same-sex marriages here. There is another question there at the bottom, right? Nab, why is math so fake, right? And I use this problem several times in my classes, and there was one year where someone did say, give me a break, somebody's gay, right? And so we saw that chat, that one message in the chat that said, you know, this is a little bit out of date. This problem is 60s. This wouldn't be the case in reality. So right away, when you just look at a subset of some of these responses, right, you can see that this problem, even aside from the math, you push the math aside, this problem is very exclusive, right? And I know for a fact, when I talk to some of my students, they couldn't see themselves in this problem context. So you can think about students, for example, that might be bisexual, right? They feel like they don't really have a place in this problem when they read it. And when I see this comment, like, why is math so fake? That reminds me so much of that other question that we get in math so often, right? Which is, when am I ever gonna use this, right? And oftentimes when I get that question, when am I ever going to use this? Not always, but most of the time, the student doesn't really want the answer to that question. It is a sign that they're frustrated, right, with the content. And so I was feeling the same thing with this question. Why is math so fake, right? So they felt like this problem isn't right, right? It just, there's something that doesn't really feel right about the problem. So I'm going to talk briefly about this four-part framework here. This is authored by Rochelle Gutierrez, The Four Pillars of Equity. And I'm also going to give a brief shout out to Luke Walsh, because last week, this was at the center of his talk on calculus, his project. And so definitely this is not the first time you're going to see this framework, definitely not the last time. But the reason I want to talk about this framework is because it did something for me. It helped me make sense of mathematics teaching. So I think when you look at a framework like this, certain parts of it, you might say, absolutely, this is what math teaching is all about. But I'll point it out right now. It's that third one about identity that for many, many years, I didn't see how that fit into good mathematics teaching. Like, what does your identity have to do with that? So I'm just going to talk briefly about the other ones, right? Access makes perfect sense because when we think of our students, do they have a teacher that cares? Do they have good curriculum materials? All those things, right, to be successful. Achievement, we don't even have to talk about that. Who's succeeding in your class and why? So this makes perfect sense for equity. And even if you look at item number four, this one took me a while, but I think active learning has really addressed the power dynamic in classrooms. So when you think to yourself, like, who is positioned to be an expert in your classroom. And I would say for the first 10 years of my teaching, it was me, right? I always thought, oh, it's all about the teacher. But then with active learning, students are doing the thinking, they're doing the mathematics, and they're in a position of power to kind of share with their classmates, right, what they have found. So it's that identity piece that was the last one for me to really make sense in terms of mathematics teaching. And what Gutierrez talks about, she's saying if a student has to sort of check themselves at the door and say, like, I have to put this off to the side to engage in the mathematical process, then that by definition is not equity. And that's what a lot of my students were saying. They were saying, this problem is fake. I can't see myself in this situation, right? And I'm talking about the students that had, for example, rainbow badges on their backpacks, right? And they would have these discussions with me. So they just didn't feel like they had a space in this problem, or they had to feel out that they had to check out right before doing it. So I think it's important to talk about this framework because for me, it finally made sense why all these four parts, right, are components of good mathematics teaching.
So the question we wanted to bring to you today is, okay, what should we as teachers do with this situation? Should we continue using this problem when our students have visible discomfort? Or do we seek an alternative where we want to ensure that students' dignity is preserved while simultaneously teaching a lot of important mathematics? And it, just as a side note, we love the mathematics of this problem with regard to the things that it brings out. And I've been using this problem for about 10 years. And in my methods class, I use it as the day one task to frame how we're going to use the mathematics and student-centered classrooms for the rest of the semester. So our initial solution in years back was we would present that problem in our respective classes and we put this tagline, assume each man is married to one woman and vice versa. So that was my way of saying, okay, I realize this problem has issues, but we're gonna put that aside and just focus on the math. And now we realize, there are better ways to tackle what's happening in our classrooms now. And especially if you're teaching pre-service teachers, it's a conversation to have for their respective classrooms when they go and they're their own teacher. So to frame this, the rest of our short time together, we have this long quote, which I'm gonna read because it's really at the heart of what we wanna talk about today. And it's from Gay's work of 2018. Culturally responsive teaching can be defined as using the cultural knowledge, prior experience, and performance styles of ethnically diverse students to make learning encounters more relevant to and effective for them. Creating caring learning communities where culturally different individuals and heritages are valued, challenging racial and cultural stereotypes, prejudices, racism, and other forms of and intolerance, injustice, and oppression. Long quote, however, we feel the following two phrases are particularly important in how we're looking at this particular problem and situation. Now, please note that culturally responsive teaching in the research literature often focuses on race and ethnicity, but we feel that this theory can be applied to LGBTQ issues just as much. So that's why we're bringing this to you today. So I'll pass it along to Keith to give a couple more insights in the theory behind this.
Yeah, so we're gonna do, we're gonna have a chance to do a little bit of math today, but I wanna talk about or share a little bit about, or I guess just be open to the fact that this is a difficult conversation that we're having. I have had this conversation with a lot of colleagues and sometimes it results in a great resolution. Other times it's just pure upset, right? Like you just see things in a different light. So this I think is important to get out in the open, this particular slide, because we feel like mathematics is like this arbiter of truth, right? There's no room for ideology. There's no room for subjectivity. Math is math, right? It tells us the truth. And I think probably 20 years ago when I started teaching, I very well thought this, but then of course with experience, things start to change. We know now that math definitely intertwines with social issues. And look at those eight words in bold, right, on the slide. Sometimes you could, or some people would argue that it's provocative to say, hey, mathematics is political, or mathematics is generational, or mathematics is linguistic. But mathematics is all of these things, right? Depending on the situation that you find yourself in and the particular context of working with your students. For example, the condo problem speaks to the word gendered, right? There are some issues there that you don't expect necessarily, but that do affect people, right? The way they feel and the way that they engage in the process of thinking about math. So I'm not gonna go through all eight, but I'm gonna show you right now two of my favorites, right? That really assert that this is the case, right? If you haven't read this book by Kathy O'Neill, I highly recommend it. It's awesome. It's all about how math can be used as a weapon, right? And how there are these gross injustices and biases in these automated systems, right? These mathematical models that we build. So I don't think there's a single mathematical equation in the book, but she talks about, hey, everything that we do in everyday life, right, basically comes from some mathematical model. We decide what goes into that model. We decide what to leave out of that model. And all of those are human decisions, right? There are people behind those decisions. And even when you have a mathematical model and you say, aha, this works, right? This does exactly what I want it to do. What does it work for? Like, what is the purpose, right? So someone decides that a mathematical model is accurate. So you can see right away, if you read her book, she touches on all these issues. For example, who gets a loan, police brutality. She even looks at the US News and World Report college rankings. So if there's a topic where there's a model, she talks about it in the book. So you walk away from this book feeling like math is very, very political, right? So it can be used in certain ways that can almost be categorized as a weapon. Another one of my favorites here, this is to say mathematics has been racialized, right? Multiplication is for white people. So this one here questions that whole idea of why is it that we assume that Black and brown children are not supposed to be high achievers, right? So that's really what this book is all about. You can be even more provocative and say, you know, can Black people do mathematics? That is a crazy question to be asking. But for example, you could look up Edre Goins, right? He's the president of NAM. And so he is a Black number theorist, and he came out with his story a few years ago about how he was ostracized, right, from the mathematics community simply because of the color of his skin. So his experience as a mathematician has been so very different from mine, right? And that's what this is really about. So there are a lot of books that touch on this idea of the intersection of our lovely subject that we love so much, mathematics, and then also race. So I'm gonna take a second right here. If you know of an awesome book that you've read recently that is at the intersection of say mathematics and maybe teaching, social justice and equity, why don't you pop it into the chat right now? And because I'm guessing there's a lot of books that I haven't read. And if we get a nice collection there in the chat, we will save it and then share it with you right after the conference. Because that would be nice to have a little collection of books. Okay, and to show you now how imprecise this is, right? These categories are not artificial. So here's one example that cuts across both culture and race, right? So you could look at newspapers, television, cartoons, whatever. So I'm sure you recognize the Family Guy and good old Peter. This episode here, this is atrocious, right? This kind of, this false stereotype that Asians are good at math. So if you remember this episode, I mean, of course, you're supposed to laugh at it, but once you laugh at it, you kind of look at yourself and say, why am I laughing? So Peter was reminiscing about how, I think he was taking a math exam and all of his classmates, right, immediately reached down and grabbed their calculators. And Peter reached down and grabbed an Asian boy and popped him on the desk and said, do math, right? So this again is a false stereotype. In fact, you can go as far as saying it objectifies Asians, right? That Asians are supposedly good at mathematics. So you can look at the work of Niral Shah, right? He's done a lot of work specific in this area. That's a myth that's been debunked time and time again. So these are just three examples from those eight words that you saw on the slide. We could do a talk just on this aspect. But if you look back at the last three, they all have to do with math, right? And they intersect with some other everyday social issue.
So it's never, it's always a good time to do some math. We're going to bring it back to the mathematics right now. And so here's what we'd like to do, because in a perfect world, we'd have you live and you'd be working in tables and groups of four teachers each. And also in real life, when we've done this session just on the mathematics, we might give you 20 to 30 minutes to actually do the problem. But in interest of time, we're going to ask you to do the following. We're going to give you 2 minutes of quiet time. It's not a lot and it's not sufficient to take some time and unpack this problem, as some of you might already have been doing if you were curious about it. We're not looking for a solution. We're looking at the following question. What strategy could you use to solve the problem? So this is something you'd say in words. And this is either what you would use to solve the problem or what you foresee your students might do to solve the problem. So we're going to give, I'm going to put my timer on here on my phone. It's now started for 2 minutes. And we'll be silent and we'd like you to take a moment and dive into the math. And then we'll ask for strategies on the count of three at the end of 2 minutes. So see you back in 2 minutes. Okay, it's been about 2 minutes. So on the count of three, please press enter on what strategies you think you and your students might go. 1, 2, 3, enter.
Jackie and Keith, whenever you want to take a moment, I do have a couple questions that have come in for you as well.
Wonderful. Thank you, Michelle. So we'll talk about the math and then we'll segue back into the questions about, I'm going to guess they're the non-math questions. So Keith, if you see any themes here in our messages, I see some drawing of pictures using manipulatives, diagrams, algebra.
I like the ask Chegg. Go Susan.
Love it.
And I can tell you, it's interesting because a lot of the people who are saying, oh, I would change the problem context. I saw Joanna wrote something about that. We're going to see that this is precisely what my students did.
Love it.
Number lines, totally awesome. I haven't even thought of that for this problem.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you all have such a myriad of responses, because I think it mirrors what our students do. So we'll just take a moment to share what we've seen our students have done in the mathematics. Bottom line is that the reason why we love this problem is it really invokes the reasoning about both ratios and fractions. And in particular, we find that our students impose fraction algorithms onto ratios, because really this is a racial problem in disguise. And the second bullet point has really the most common strategies from our students, as you can see, many of which do not give a valid solution on their first try. So in this chat, I saw some of your strategies kind of mirror those. And again, if we had the time, we can dive into the math, but I'll share one of the most common strategies, which is called common numerators. And it can be done both symbolically and using two color counters. So if you flip to this slide, thanks. You will see, so spoiler alert, this does allude to the solution, but you can see here that this building up of counters physically represents the common numerator strategy. And here you can see that the 2/3 and the 3/5 represented on the top line can be repeated or cloned until the number of married men equals the number of married women. So there's some interesting conversations that occur with how you add fractions compared to how you combine ratios, and it usually blows our students' minds. So that said, this is why we love the mathematics, but we have some questions and answers that maybe we can skip to now.
Yeah, sure, that's totally fine.
Kind of bring things together for you, everyone.
Sure, so do you want me to go ahead and read you the questions now?
Sure.
Perfect. Okay, so the first question, I believe that instructors, we in our questions should make every effort to, well, this is more of just a comment, should make every effort to be socially, culturally, and ethically aware, sensitive, and inclusive. And then the follow-up question tied to that, I live in a very conservative area and efforts to do so are often met with pushback from students feeling canceled or just tuning out and, or just them tuning out entirely. How do you best address this in a math class?
Do you want to take that, Jackie, or you want me to take it?
Yeah, I can start by sharing a very quick story, and maybe you can add on. I also taught a very conservative student who, when she was a college student, but what happened was that we were very honest, and what happened was that one of my pre-service teachers had a field experience in a kindergarten classroom in which the kids were playing house, and a fight ensued because one kid said to the other, I'll be the dad and you be the dad, because that was their experience in their house. And the other kid said, that's not possible. You can't have two dads. And the first child said, but I have two dads. So the conversation I had with my pre-service teachers basically were, what happens when you as a teacher, or you work and live in a community with values that differ from the experience of some of our children. So one way that we found to kind of mitigate that was to talk about how no matter what your beliefs are, what the community's beliefs are, is to approach a problem in a situation in terms of how much our students can feel belonging. So putting faith, conservative politics aside, how can we make each and every student feel like they belong and that they're valued, even if our values don't match another? I don't know if that's the best answer, but at least that's my experience in reframing. It's not about our beliefs, but it's about our making our children feel that they're valued. And that's a hard sell for some, I understand. And it's not the best answer, but that's my first take on that. Keith, what can you add to that?
Yeah, my answer was gonna be brutally honest. And this part of the reason we actually wanted to do this talk is because we don't really have an answer to that question. this is one of the first problems that I have encountered where the issue, this issue of gender norms came up. And so I'm, you know, part of the reason for our talk is I'll talk about what I did in my classroom with a group of prospective teachers, but I gather that this would look very different in different classes and obviously with a very conservative population. I don't know what best action to take, right? So this is why we wanted to kind of open up this conversation, like what do you do? And I feel like we need to start having that conversation in math education.
I do have another question here too.
Sure.
Is this question, your math question, assuming that the man and the woman are married to each other only within the group? That's the question.
Yeah, that is what it is. So it's like so that again kind of echoes the artificiality of math problems. Like we have this condo community, all the marriages occur within that community. Was that the question? Because that's what the problem assumes.
Good question.
Yeah. Okay, so go ahead, Michelle.
I just said those are all the questions that I have right now.
Perfect. Yep. So I want to talk about what I did with my group, right? So this was a group of math for elementary school teachers. I used this problem many, many times. And this is like a tip of the hat to Joanna. I saw your thing in the chat, right? You were like, there's got to be a way to write this problem that doesn't involve this, right? So this is actually the exercise I assigned to my students because I didn't really know what to do with this problem. So I asked them on a whim, can you rewrite this problem so that all the mathematics, all the good math is retained? But we don't have that feeling of like, why are we doing this problem? There's something like not right about this problem. So I basically asked them to rewrite it. And what's interesting, this is just a small subset of the responses because I received over 50. If you look at the two short ones in the center, these two students, when they rewrote the problem, they're like, I need to get away from gender, right? So she's saying 2/3 of my jeans fit, 3/5 of my shirts fit, what fraction of my clothes fit, right? So this was an interesting way to rewrite the problem. And I should also mention that rewriting the problem was very difficult. We got a lot of rewritten problems that were actually incorrect. So the problem that was rewritten was not actually mathematically isomorphic to the condo problem. So it was a good exercise in how do you write a good problem. If you look at the third one about the animal shelter, that's about spots, right? This many dogs have brown spots, this many cats have brown spots. But if you look at the first and the fourth, there were some students that felt differently. They said, I wanna keep the element of companionship, right? Because that's what this problem is about. So this first student wrote about guinea pigs, right? Being social creatures and they team up with a buddy. So you can see how they sort of avoid, you know, the gender of the buddy. You could just have a buddy, right? So what an interesting way to rewrite the problem, right? And these are, again, prospective teachers coming up with these problems. And then the one down here, I remember the student, I can see his face, right? So he talked about penguins, right? And how they mate for life. And so that's the example that he used. So I think this was an informative exercise for them because it made them at least be critical of curriculum, right? So you have to look at the problems that we're giving our students and say, are these really appropriate? Because like the condo problem, you might love the math, but you don't know what your students are feeling inside, right? When they actually see the problem. So that that was the best I could do, I felt, with this audience, right? I wanna share with you now some very frank conversations that I had with my students after we were done with this problem. So these were things that occurred either by email or they dropped by my office or they hung out after class, right? And these are some of the things that they said about this problem, right? If you just read these, you can get the sense that they just felt that this problem was outdated, right? And I saw that in the chat, right? This problem needs updating. It's great language down here that this problem looks like it has an expiration date, right? So these are students and this is how they felt about the problem. And these students shared that with me, right? They were very honest. And because these teachers, right? These students could be teaching your children tomorrow, right? They're prospective teachers. They also provided some commentary on pedagogy, right? And when I read these two quotes, I really feel like the teachers understood that, hey, you know, we teach math, but we work with people, right? So the problems that we provide and the activities that we give our students, children are going to be affected by that, right? They're going to think about the problem. They might not see fractions in the problem first. They might look at the problem context. And like we heard before, they'll say, you know what? I can't see myself in this problem, right? Math is too fake. And that's what you're seeing here in these quotes.
And just a note, because I saw some things in the chat about rewriting the problem. Of those 50 or so that came in, only a third of the problems were in fact isomorphic to the first original problem, and meaning that it was the same final answer and that was a similar solution strategy. So that was surprising. It was a difficult task.
Yes, it was. Okay, so now I've got some bad news for you, right? Because when I think of this, I'm like, you know what? If the condo problem is the only problem out there that has this issue of making us uncomfortable, right, when it comes to gender norms, then let's solve that problem and we'll be done, right? This conversation will be finished. But of course, you know, the bad news is that there are problems like this in every single sub-discipline of math across every single grade band, right? So you don't have to look very hard to find them. So this is a problem that I used, and I was only really mortified once I realized, you know, that who my students were, right? So this problem here, it's the one on statistics. It's a wonderful problem where you collect all this data. These students are racing to type in a text message accurately. So it's a very engaging task. The problem with the task is the question. And the question is, who is better at texting, boys or girls? So if you think about your transgender students, your non-binary students, your gender fluid students, there really isn't a place here, and it's very, very difficult. I can think of about 10 things that you shouldn't do, right, when you have a problem like this and you have students there who feel completely alienated. This problem here, this discrete math problem, I like this problem mainly because it's very, very subtle, right? If you look at this one, this is about a dance party, and it says every boy should dance with at least one girl. No girl dances with all the boys. So the clue or the insinuation here is that it's normal for boys to dance with girls, right? So this is about conformity and social expectation. I start to think of things when I read a problem like this, you know, boys shouldn't wear nail polish, girls shouldn't have short hair, girls shouldn't play with trucks, right? So students can read a lot into a problem like this. And I don't think it's being overly sensitive. I think we have to think that when we give problems like this, you have to think of the implications of the problem. Because sometimes they don't see the math, right? They don't see this as a discrete math problem. They see it as a social problem. I'll show you a few more here. Here's a problem from Illustrative Math, which is a great curriculum. And this one, again, it goes back to gender identity or being in a state of transition, right? So when you see a problem just like this, 9 boys and 8 girls, how many children were in the class, right? So immediately mirroring some of the other problems, you can detect some possible discomfort, right, in that context. This book here at the bottom, The Discrete Math Problem, is a wonderful book. It's super popular. And I'm not here to knock any books, but I'll knock the problem, right? Because this problem here is just like the condo problem. So it's all about marriage, and it's a great counting problem, right? We're talking about 3 married couples, but you don't really know how a married couple is defined until you get to part C. And then when you get there, it's very clear, right? So men occupy the first 3, women the last 3. So it's, again, that heteronormative view of what marriage is.
We do have one more question that came in. Would you like to take the question?
Yeah, sure, we can do that.
From an ageism point of view, is a widow or a widower still considered married?
Oh yeah, that is not my professional domain.
I don't know either. I read that question a couple minutes ago, but I think someone else is going to be I hope someone else has that answer to that question, or maybe we can Google it. I don't have that as well, but that's a good question.
All right. And then here's just a couple more. This first problem is repulsive. You don't even have to read all of it, right? Sultan arranges his wives, ... right? So polygamy is still legal in many parts of the world, but it goes without saying that this one provides a very uncomfortable context for doing mathematics, right? Your kids are going to be talking about the problem and not about the beautiful math in the problem. And then we kept on finding this over and over again. This bottom problem again refers to refers to gender identity. So that's our conclusion here is we thought maybe this is an isolated thing and we didn't have to look very hard to find out that this is not, right? So, and definitely Jackie and I are here not to tell you, hey, this is what you do with these problems, because frankly, I don't have a solution for it, right? And that's the reason we're here. And nor are we here to tell you like how you should feel about these problems. But what I can tell you is I know that it made my students very uncomfortable. And they were very honest with me in sharing that.
So we have a couple takeaways, three. We tried to sum up what we would love for you to take away from our short time together. Number one is simply the awareness that math intersects social issues. And math teachers are across the spectrum on where we are on this issue personally. And as Keith said, if you do have these conversations, you know, people have a lot of emotional attachment to it, depending on their beliefs going into this. The second takeaway is that culturally responsive teaching, we feel, is everyone's responsibility. And this includes the discomfort that and difficult conversations that occurs not only with our students, but with our colleagues. Now, like Keith, we'll take number three.
Sure. And so I alluded to this before that, like, what do you do? Because a few of you even asked this, like, what do we do in these situations? And so I had what I thought was almost a solution with my Math for Elementary School teachers, and that is to at least address the inequity and then just do something about it, right? An exercise in curriculum, and to tell them, guess what? This is not gonna be your first time doing this, nor your last time, because when you go into the classroom and you have to teach children, you're going to encounter problems similar to this. So I leave you with this question, whether you teach courses like QR or Calculus 1 or differential equations, whatever it is, if you encounter a problem where you perceive there is an inequity, what are you going to do about that? Like, how do you want to approach that? Because I think it would look different depending on your students, as we've heard, depending on their particular standpoint on many of these social issues, and then also depending on the course, right? What the objective of the course really is. So that's something where, you know, I like sessions where they leave you with a question, right? So I don't have an answer for that, but I'm leaving you with that because I want you to think about it. I think it's going to happen sooner than you think, where you'll get a problem and you'll say, aha, what do I do with this, right? It's very difficult.
But in the past, I did nothing. And in doing nothing, that's a choice. And now I realize that's something I'm not comfortable with anymore. I need to do something, and that changes, depending on that class. So here's a quote that Keith found.
Yeah, this is a great quote by Constance Camille. So it's pretty awesome because it's saying, you know, you can't grow and develop, right, intellectually if you're, suppressed socially or morally. So that here, I think, really kind of captures everything that we're talking about, right? We can choose to ignore, like Jackie was saying, and do nothing, but that itself is an explicit choice. So this, we wanted to share this with you if you want to dive deeper, right? Because we wrote about this in the NCTM Journal, and all those wonderful people that you see on this, these are students of mine. They were so passionate about this, and they felt it was a very important thing to do So we shared it with the world. So if you want to read a little bit